Good afternoon, everyone, on this blustery, blowy, but sunny Juneau afternoon here on a Friday. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today. And today we're going to find out all about a really cool basketball program called Hoop Time. We're going to talk to author Brian Kastner about a preview of his Friday night presentation that's going to be happening at the Valley Library. Zach Brown will be here to talk about his Friday night lecture on A Trip North at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. And Laura Statz is going to be here to highlight next weekend's health fair. That's all coming up on a Juneau afternoon, plus Writer's Almanac and Bird Note and so much more. Stay tuned, won't you? First, here's National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native people and their allies marched in Washington, D.C. Friday morning to raise awareness of environmental issues and Native rights. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and grassroots leaders are calling on President Trump and his administration to meet with them and listen to their concerns, including about the Dakota Access Pipeline. The day's events also include speeches by tribal leaders, politicians, activists, and musicians. A Sixth Circuit court judge heard oral arguments about the Keystone XL pipeline this week in South Dakota. Opponents filed an appeal after the State Public Utilities Commission gave the go-ahead for the project. They claim the commission did not do its job to ensure TransCanada can build a safe pipeline. But the regulators and companies say the outcome followed state law. Victoria Wicks has more.
Inside the Hughes County Courthouse, lawyers do the talking. There are no witnesses called. Judge John Brown hears oral arguments after having reviewed briefs and exhibits. Outside the courthouse, before the hearing begins, opponents come together for a few speeches and prayers. Here, tribal members are in the majority. One of them is Brandon Sazu, the chairman of the Crow Creek Tribe. He says he went to North Dakota to protest the Dakota Access Pipeline and was arrested. He's still facing charges there. In jail, he met a journalist who had also been arrested. Sazu says he's committed to relying on tenets of democracy rather than violence.
Yeah, we don't use bullets. I mean, the only ones who use bullets are the police or all the military people. I mean, we use our voices, we use our hearts, we use the Constitution of the United States, the freedom of speech, the right to assemble.
Sazu is emphatic that treaties grant First People certain rights over land, even if that land has disappeared from shrinking reservations.
First and foremost, the supreme law of the land is the treaties. The government forced those treaties upon us. So we rely on those treaties. We follow those treaties. It's the government that doesn't follow those treaties.
Among those claimed rights are clean drinking water and preservation of burial sites, artifacts, and traditional and sacred places, which tribes say are threatened by the Keystone XL pipeline. The judge will issue a decision at a later date. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks, reporting from Pierre, South Dakota.
Wisconsin's Menominee Tribe of Indians has filed a case in Michigan to stop a proposed mine on ancestral land. Wisconsin Public Radio's Patty Murray reports.
Aquila Resources wants to mine for gold and possibly zinc or copper at a site near Stevenson, Michigan. The proposed Back 40 mine site is in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, just across the border from Wisconsin. It's on ancestral land ceded by the Menominee Tribe of Indians in 1836. Tribal Chair Gary Besaw says there are culturally significant burial mounds and garden beds on or near the mine site that he fears will be disturbed.
They're asking that they not mine in this area for some of the ecological reasons until it can be done in a process that does not put the environment at the risk it does. And we also ask that they not destroy the burial mounds in those ancestral areas.
The mining permit has been approved by Michigan, but air and water quality permits are yet to be. Hal Fitch oversees mining permits for the Michigan Division of Environmental Quality. He says people from the department have met with tribal officials and have held a series of public hearings on the proposed mine. Fitch says state archaeologists have also looked at the land.
I think there's some mound sites, some garden sites and so forth, and maybe some burial sites. Those, the actual pertinent features there were outside of the area that's proposed to be mined.
There's no timeline as to when the Menominee's contested case will be heard. For National Native News, Patty Murray.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by Bears Ears National Monument, created to honor tribes and protect traditional access. You can tell President Trump to honor tribes and protect Bears Ears at protectbearsears.org.
Support by the Fred Jones Jr. Museum of Art at the University of Oklahoma. Photosynthesis. New photographs by Navajo Will Wilson plus early works by Edward Curtis. Photosynthesis through April 2nd. Info at fjjma.ou.edu.
Native Voice 1. The Native American Radio Service.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services, providing services for identification, evaluation, and rehabilitation for individuals with hearing difficulties. Located in the Jordan Creek Center. Information at 789-6780.
Yo, Chuck, where you at, G?
I think he went upstairs, you know.
Over a furious mixture of noise, what Public Enemy producer Hank Shockley calls music's worst nightmare.
Hey, this is the kid.
Rising up in a belt, Strong Island, New York, the hood, in case you did not know my face.
Oh, Public Enemy, I love that song, Air Hoodlum. We're going to talk hoops with folks from Hoop Time right now. How's everyone doing? Jenny Twito is here. Jenny,
hey.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us, Andy.
Yeah, absolutely. And Garrett and Jackson are here. And you guys are eighth graders that have been doing hoop. How long have you guys been doing the Hoop Time program?
Me and Garrett have been in Hoop Time since sixth grade.
Okay, so the last 3 years or so you've been doing it, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. All right. And you guys are on the Floyd Dryden team as well, which you just informed me went undefeated. So awesome. Congratulations.
Thank
yes.
you.
Was there so that was the season, and then was there a tournament that you guys won as well, or how did that go?
Yeah.
So where was the tournament?
DZ.
Okay. And not even close, or what? You guys just you guys are ballers, right? You're playing. Yeah. All right. So but tell me what Hoop Time is. Tell me about that program. Yeah.
Well, Hoop Time's been around since 2002. It's a nonprofit basketball organization, and it really works on fundamentals and skills, teaching these guys good sportsmanship. In fourth through eighth grade, boys and girls, it's really a great organization.
And it's a kind of split into two things, right? There's a fundamentals part, and then there's a competition part, right?
Right.
Is that how it goes? Yeah.
We start at the beginning of the year and have 4 or 5 weeks or so of fundamentals. And then the second half is competition, where they actually are playing games and learning plays and playing against other teams. These guys have scrimmaged against the, you know, ninth grade high school teams, the varsity girls team, the seventh grade team for Hoop Time. So they try to get as much competition as they can in locally.
What's your toughest competition among those groups?
I'd have to say the JDC team, ninth grade team.
Ninth grade team. I mean, they're a team. They're playing together as a team, right, already. And then they're probably a little bit bigger, been playing a little bit longer, right?
I don't know. We have probably 5-6 foot plus boys on this team.
Yeah, these guys are big.
Yeah. Yeah, they shot up this year.
Yeah, so is your team big? Is that the big advantage? Are you guys shooters or what's?
Oh, we're all around.
Fast?
Yeah.
Offensive-minded, defensive-minded?
I think we can do everything.
You can do everything. You're amazing. Well, that's good. That's good. It's also good to be confident.
They don't lack that for sure.
No, that's a good thing. So what position do you play? What position do you play?
I play center.
And you?
Center.
Center, both centers. Do you kind of – what does that mean, though? Are you guys kind of switching over to power forward? Are you switching over – is there a lot of rotation and stuff, right?
Yeah, a lot of us are interchangeable.
Yeah, right. So it's wild. I think it's been wild to watch how the game of basketball has been changing just in the last, 5 years, the Steph Curry phenomenon and all that, right? And so is three-point shooting a big emphasis now for you guys, too?
Not for our team. Our coach likes us to look for layups, easy shots.
I love it. Fundamentals. I love it. Yeah.
Every one of these guys will fire off a three-point shot whenever they get the chance.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, but it's. Did you play?
I did.
Yeah.
I played.
The game has changed.
It has changed.
It's really amazing just how much that gunning is just a part of the sport now.
And I think athleticism alone in, you know, these guys have changed a lot.
Yeah.
It's changed the game a lot.
Yeah. And it's incredible. I mean, like, every single one of the shots that Curry puts up is one that typically a coach would be yelling, no, right? And it goes in, and he's amazing.
Well, we can't all be Curry.
But everyone wants to be, right?
Yeah.
Everyone, right? Is that everyone wants to be Curry, right? That kind of thing? Is that the favorite? Is that your guys' favorite player?
Mine's Kevin Durant.
Nice. KD, all right.
I like DeMar DeRozan, plays for the Raptors.
All right, yeah, that's cool. So, KD, even after the switch over, You're good with that.
Yeah. There's still Russell Westbrook.
And Russell Westbrook is a phenomenal, incredible player. Yeah. So, and you guys follow the NBA more than you follow college?
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. Do you have favorite college teams too, or?
North Carolina, Tar Heels.
Duke.
So my dad went to Duke and my mom went to North Carolina. So this is perfect.
Carrots.
In my house, this is a big fight because my mom went to Duke. My mom went to North Carolina. My dad went to Duke. I went to the University of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a year when University of Florida knocked Duke out of the tournament. That was a good year for me.
Yeah. So Duke and Carolina play today.
Yeah.
But
right.
That, like, probably right now.
There you go. So let's get back to hoop time.
Yeah.
So there's a really cool thing going on that's kind of a thing that you guys are letting everyone know about, which is that Papa Murphy's is teaming up with you guys to donate some money, get some money going your way. So how's that going to work?
Yeah. So this Sunday, the 12th, all day long, you go into Papa Murphy's, you call Papa Murphy's. All you have to say is hoop time or basketball, some sort of fundraiser or something to let her know that you're there to support the team. And they're going to put those receipts in a jar, and then she's going to give us a portion of all of the sales for the day.
Yeah, that's cool. It says that they're going to donate 25% of the purchase to the 8th grade boys hoop time travel team. So you guys are looking to do what with that? You got a big potential trip coming up, right?
Jack, what's the tell us about the Wasilla trip?
So next Thursday we're going to be traveling to Wasilla to be competing in the March Mania tournament. We played last year.
How'd you do last year?
Not very well.
No,
but we're looking to come back.
Is it a multiple game kind of tournament? Do you get to play a couple games even if you lose the first time, or?
Yeah.
So did you guys just kind of go up and
think
two
we won
games? One
game.
That's good.
But, you know, we're looking to come back.
Yeah, great experience, right? And go get competition and, like, the style of play, all that kind of stuff. Did you feel like when you went up there, did it just seem really fast, or did the guys seem big, or you just felt like you didn't bring your A game, or?
All the guys were a lot bigger than
big. Me. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so it is. It's cool to kind of go and get, you know, when you travel, all of a sudden it's like, okay, I'm out of my comfort zone a little bit, right? I don't know these guys, and you're playing different guys, yeah.
Yeah, and Juno has very unique challenges when it comes to travel and exposure to playing different teams and things like that. So I love that Hoop Time takes the time and effort to plan some trips for these boys to get exposed to other players and other teams.
And then there's the potential of a actual national trip coming up, right?
Wait, Garrett, you want to tell them about that one?
We are going to Vegas to play, and there's like 200 teams.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What time of year is that going to be?
That one's called the Bigfoot Hoops Easter Tournament, so it's in mid-April.
Okay, wow, cool. And then do you guys have experience with that one before? You never been to it or anything?
No.
Nope.
Just kind of researched it online a little bit?
Well, traditionally, eighth grade team gets a national trip.
Oh, okay.
So we do a local trip. Seventh and eighth graders get a local trip here in Alaska, and then we try to send the eighth graders from this Hoop Time organization to down south somewhere for a bigger tournament.
Very cool. You guys excited about that one, I'm sure. Right?
Definitely.
And that one, that's serious competition. 200 teams?
200 teams. There are 9-year-old to 17-year-olds. It's a huge tournament, probably 250 teams.
Wow. And where do they hold the games? Do you know? It's like UNLV or something, or?
I'm not really sure about the venue.
Yeah. Yeah, but anyway, cool.
Yeah, so that's mid-April. So that's what this fundraising is for.
That's that, you know, moment in Hoosiers. You walk in, it's the big arena. It's like, oh, it's scary. But yeah. But no, you know, it's the same. Get out the measuring tape. Hoop's the same height, all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
So the big thing here is a very cool deal happening where if you go to Papa Murphy's this Sunday, March 12th, and you order a pizza and you say Hoop Time, or b-ball or
fundraiser, yeah,
whatever. Papa Murphy's is going to donate 25% of your purchase to the 8th grade boys hoop time basketball travel team, and it'll allow these guys to get to Wasilla and maybe even get to Vegas and all that cool stuff, contribute to that trip, and get these guys playing ball, representing Juneau.
Right.
Thanks, you guys.
We appreciate the local support. Everybody's been great so far, and we hope to see a lot of you guys out on Sunday.
Yeah, sounds great. Well, thanks so much for coming in. Jenny, Garrett, and Jackson, appreciate you guys all coming in and letting us know about hoop time.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
No problem.
And good luck.
Thank you.
All right.
Rising up in the belt, Strong Island, New York, the hood, in case you did not know my face. There was a ball player who had all the skills with the pill to pay the paper, plus all the bills. Make his first name, Mac the awesome game, practice in the heat and the rain, the impact. Make so quick at 6'6". Down to be hit by anyone but the Celtics. Oh, what a handle could score from the floor with people banging on him or even hanging on him. But what he did best above all the rest was a player that can lead with the best of them.
As a high school phenom,
he's Skywalker himself.
I felt he could do to make this an effective basketball team.
Grades 9 and 10, Mick and Mac was on that buddy class is bad. That way in the back, how I know, cause I know I used to blow with the bro. He didn't mind, I used to read him his own headlines, cause he could not read him in school. Wouldn't beat him if the lines wouldn't have went like this. Mickey Mac jumped over the candlestick. His stack was his stats, but his team was still whack. 11 and 12, he found the wrong clientele and all. During class, he would dribble in the hall, but never got in trouble in school. But the trouble was, it was cool if your brain was just another bubble. As long as you could score 52, get 33 rebounds. Around teams lost to him, they went right through him. Division, county, state, last three count 'em. Championships for small town pro that's bound to go pro. SATs didn't matter, cause he was all that. You know the pat on the back. He was always in the news. You gotta know what it means. It means revenue. And I'm telling you, I saw cars and G's come to our school. Please, I broke hell with the principal. Where's the coach?
Hey, welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. Andy Klein with you, and joining me now is Arthur Brian Kastner. Brian, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Appreciate
for having
it.
Me.
And also Jeremy Pataki's here from 49 Riders, and you're the organization that brought Brian into town to give us a preview of some of the stuff that he's doing, and there's a presentation at the Valley Library today as well.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes, and we actually were working with our partners, the Alaska Humanities Forum, and we got some help as well from Juneau Public Libraries.
Very cool. Well, Brian, tell folks what type of work that you do so that...
Sure.
So that they know, get a little bit of an idea of your work. And
of course. Yeah. So I'm a military veteran. I was in the Air Force as an explosive ordnance disposal officer. We were the guys who took apart roadside bombs and IEDs in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I did that for a while and came home and had some struggles like a lot of veterans who do coming home. And I started writing about it. So my first book, The Long Walk, came out a few years ago, and it's about taking apart bombs in Iraq and then struggles coming home.
But then you've really expanded into a lot of areas of writing. So, what other stuff have you...
Yeah, so you have this great opportunity. You write one book and suddenly editors will return your emails.
But they might want to pigeonhole you too, right?
A lot of writers would kill for a beat, of course. And at the same time, you want to be able to do other stuff. So I'm fortunate. I went to Liberia during the Ebola crisis to write about that. This past summer, actually, I paddled the Mackenzie River in the Northwest Territories, Great Slave Lake, all the way to the Arctic Ocean to write about climate change and travel law and that kind of stuff.
Maybe the focus of what you're going to be talking about tonight, trip north, is what that is?
Yeah, so tonight we're going to be talking about writing nonfiction kind of generally, and when you interview people, whether they were indigenous, out on the land in Northwest Territories or in Liberia or military veterans. I do a lot of interviewing, and when you do that and you write about these subjects, you know, what do you owe these folks? As a writer, you realize you're often like you're selling them out. They're sharing their story with you, and then they know that you're spreading it to the world, but they don't always know what that means.
Do you think that your combat experience made you a better interviewer, or is there a way that affected
that whole experience?
Did that affect you as far as being able to?
You know, when we were in Iraq taking apart bombs, a lot of the stuff you're doing is investigations of a bomb that's already detonated. And so you end up asking questions of local people, what happened here. But you realize that you're meeting them on the worst day of their life,
right?
When this thing detonated. So I've been drawn, obviously, with the, like I told you, the kind of work I do, I'm drawn to some of these extreme situations. And I guess it did make me better at being willing to approach somebody, the Liberian Red Cross workers who are picking up, you know, the Ebola-laden bodies, you know, and transporting them. So I get, that didn't intimidate me. And maybe it would have some other writers,
From
having that experience.
You've been through so much in your personal experience, that sort of thing.
Right.
It's an interesting thing to think about how that, obviously, that's something that shaped your life, and it must shape your work in some ways as well. Do you feel like that you bring that sort of a different perspective to your work, even if you're doing something about traveling a river because of that?
Yeah, I think absolutely that I've figured out for myself I'm drawn to stories about people struggling against inhuman things, whether it be the wilderness or a disease or war or something else. Like those are the stories that to me feel like they're really worth telling. They're where, human nature and human condition is really tested, and you learn something about a person, or the reader learns something about themselves from reading about somebody very much like them, but in this situation that's like really hard for them to imagine and different from their own personal experience.
Is it harder to write about things that aren't as immediately dramatic?
I mean, I find that, and that's so there's this old adage that you write what you know, right? So if you live in Juneau and you go hike to the ice caves like we just did today, you know,
awesome, right?
It was amazing. Totally awesome. It was sunny today. It was amazing. You know, so you see that and you want to write about glaciers and the mountains and, you know, outside and nature and all that stuff. And that's great. And I think so. I don't know. I don't need to judge it about like what's compelling to the writer. If whoever, whatever they feel moved by, that's certainly what they should be writing about.
Yeah. And so, what are some of the messages you try to bring when you're talking, when you're doing a workshop, or when you're bringing ideas like this to writers who are maybe new or haven't done it before?
Yeah, we're doing this workshop tomorrow, and it's for, you know, new writers and experienced writers. And what I've noticed is that a lot of experiences that make somebody want to write, when their skidoo fell through the ice on the lake, or when their brother got sent to combat, or some like these big things that happen in our lives that you want to write about, there's a lot of pressure to get it exactly right. And so it can be intimidating. Like they know that they want to capture this experience, but it's hard to even start because internal pressure, like, well, whatever I do, it's just not going to turn out right. It's not going to feel the same. It's like, you know,
it's not going to be honest enough or true enough or
right. They write the story and then they immediately apologize for it, that it's like it's somehow not good enough. And I think what we're going to try to work on is how do you get to the point where you feel like this story feels right? And that's what I try to do in all my writing, is get the feeling right. So that way it feels true as much as all the facts are right.
Were you a writer before you went to combat?
No, but I think it made me a better writer. And not just for the interviewing. I think that in combat, especially when you're taking apart bombs like I did, your job is to notice little things. And I think great writing is full of all that little noticing.
Mm. And so, but is it the thing that inspired you to begin writing?
Well, yeah, and it gave me something worth writing about. You know, I think I had wanted to write, but I don't know, didn't feel inspired by making tea in my kitchen, you know. But the war did give me something that, you know, my first book, it was like a biological process. Like I had to do it.
I was going to ask that. Was there a specific moment when you sat down and like, this is it, I got to start? Or did it just draw, did it come out of a slow process?
I was out on a run, and I was doing a lot of running to kind of deal with coming home. And I can tell you the exact footfall on this particular street on a day in April where I said, you know what, maybe I've got a story here that people would want to read.
And that was it. That was the beginning of this journey.
I got started.
Wow, that's inspiring.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think I didn't think that writing was something adults did. I thought adults got real jobs and paid bills.
Sure, well, some do.
and they probably should. And I'm really fortunate that I've been able to pay some bills with writing too. But the point is, I never seriously considered it. And I'm not sure why. I never met a writer until I became a writer, which is kind of a funny thing. You know, so I think that's part of the idea of the workshop, too, and the event tonight at the library is that, you know, writers are not, I don't know, they're not all, you know, dead or whatever else, you know, people in the library. There's lots of active writers in this community as well. And, like, that's it's a thing that other people, that everybody can, like, pick up and start themselves.
So when you came home, you kind of, you felt that you had the PTSD sort of symptoms and that was happening with you, that was something you identified that was happening. Do you feel that was this a cathartic thing?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'd be lying to you if I said it wasn't. But at the same time, I realized that people don't want to read the catharsis itself. And the little notes we make for ourselves or writing out on a sketch pad of what's bothering you, taking control of your own story, taking control of your life, figuring out for yourself, why do I feel this way, all this grief or anxiety or whatever it is. Like, that can be really useful to the person, but that's not literature that anybody else would want to pick up, you know, in book form. And so I realized pretty early on that the things I was doing to help myself therapeutically is very different from the story I wanted to write, and I was really concentrated on writing the best book I could.
Yeah. What inspired you to take this river trip?
Writing another book. I'm like we talked about being pigeonholed in war,
yeah.
And I've written a couple war books.
I mean, war to Ebola. I mean, it's man, right?
Right. It's all pretty heavy.
Yeah.
And instead, I'm writing history and travelogue, and I'm writing about Alexander Mackenzie himself, and then what I discovered on the river. And I love outdoors, and I'm a whitewater rafting guide, and I just feel really fortunate that I'm getting an opportunity to, like, you know, do it in this professional way.
Very cool. Well, Jeremy, give us some of the details on what's going to be happening tonight at the Valley.
Well, so at 6 o'clock tonight, Brian's doing a reading and craft talk at the Mendenhall Library in the Valley. It's free. Everyone's welcome. Should be a lot of fun. Tomorrow, he's teaching an all-day workshop that starts at 10 at the APK classroom and ends at 4. And that does require advanced registration. There's a couple seats left. There's discounts for veterans. And if people get on it and look at 49writers.org and get in touch quickly, there's even a couple opportunities to get scholarshiped in if you're a veteran or an active duty military person, Coast Guard person. So.
And tell me a little bit about 49 Writers and how people maybe can get involved in that more.
Well, 49 Writers is a statewide literary nonprofit. We're in our 8th year, based out of Anchorage, but we serve the whole state with events, classes, workshops. We have a pretty lively online community, a collaborative blog written by Alaskans for Alaskans. And all that is sort of accessible through 49writers.org. We're also on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And we have a pretty solid membership base here in Juneau. We've been much more active in Southeast over the last couple of years. And so actually Brian's the second author we've brought in from out of state this winter here. We had the poet Roger Reeves in recently, and there's a lot more good things ahead. So it's really been fun being in a position to better serve Southeast along with South Central and beyond.
Yeah. What's one or two kind of main points of advice you typically give writers at workshops or when you're talking to folks?
Read.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't learn to write by going to a college program or something. I learned by just devouring books and then forgiving yourself when you're writing and just write and write and write. I believe in that Malcolm Gladwell 10,000-hour rule, and the only way you get to good writing is by lots of bad writing, you know, before it. But get through that. Everybody has to get through that somehow. And then it's, you know, practice might not make perfect, but at least get you a long way.
There's that thing, that frustration of what's on the page. This isn't what I meant to say at all. It sounds ridiculous, that kind of thing, right? And you just have to...
Right, and I don't know, some famous writer said that there is no writing, there's only rewriting. So and the more I write, the more willing I am to just write absolute crap and then go back and make it right later.
Right. Well, thanks so much. Great talking to you. Brian Kastner is here, and he's going to be speaking at the Valley Library tonight. And Jeremy, thanks so much for coming in from 49 Writers and bringing Brian to town. So great to meet you, Brian. Thanks for coming in.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, coming up next, very fittingly, here is Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 10th of March, 2017. It's the birthday of the playwright and novelist David Raby, born in Dubuque, Iowa, 1940, drafted and sent off to Vietnam, and wrote a trilogy of plays about Vietnam, The Basic Training of Pavlo Hummel, Sticks and Bones, and Streamers. Most recent play is Visiting Edna. David Raby, who said, "I get a sentence, an idea, an image, and I start. I don't know anything beyond it, I follow it." It was on this day in 1959, 300,000 Tibetans surrounded the Dalai Lama's palace to protest China's nearly decade-long occupation. They were afraid that the Dalai Lama was going to be kidnapped by the Chinese, and it was soon after that that the Dalai Lama was evacuated to India, along with tens of thousands of his followers. Other thousands who remained behind were killed by Chinese military, monasteries destroyed. It's the birthday of the lexicologist Henry Fowler, born in Tunbridge, Kent, 1858, author of A Dictionary of Modern English Usage. It was Henry Fowler who said, "Display of superior knowledge is as great a vulgarity as display of superior wealth." He wrote, "Prefer the familiar word to the far-fetched, prefer the concrete word to the abstract, prefer the single word to the circumlocution, prefer the short word to the long, prefer the Saxon word to the romantic." Fowler wrote, "Anyone who wishes to become a good writer should endeavor, before he allows himself to be tempted by the more showy qualities, to be direct, simple, brief, vigorous, and lucid." And Fowler said, "Paragraphing is a matter of the eye. A reader will address himself more readily to his task if he sees from the start that he will have breathing spaces from time to time than if what is before him looks like a marathon course." Here's a poem for today by Lucy Shaw entitled Revival. "March, I'm beginning to anticipate a thaw. Early mornings, the earth, old unbeliever, is still crusted with frost where the moles have nosed up their cold castings, and the ground cover in shadow under the cedars hasn't softened for months, fogs layering their slow, complicated ice around foliage and stem night by night. But as the light lengthens, preacher of good news, evangelizing leaves and branches, his large gestures beckon green out of gray, pinpricks of coral bursting from the cotoneasters, a single bee finding the white heather, eager lemon-yellow aconites glowing low to the ground like little uplifted faces, a crocus shooting up a purple hand here, there, as I stand on my doorstep, my own face drinking in heat and light like a bud welcoming resurrection, and my hand up too ready to sign on for conversion." A poem by Lucy Shaw, Revival, from her collection What the Light Was Like, published by Word Farm, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, now available on iOS devices, subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Hi, this is Derek Lill, Event Supervisor at Centennial Hall with CBJ Parks and Recreation. Our team and I are looking forward to planning your event at Centennial Hall, Juneau's convention center located in the heart of downtown's Willoughby District. We offer a variety of equipment for rent, technical support, and room setup, and work with caterers to assist you in making your vision for the event come true. For more information, call 586-5283 or visit our website, centennialhall.net.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air.
No, and our next guest has kind of been everywhere. When you're talking about coastal Pacific Northwest and coastal inside waters, Zach Brown is with us. Zach, thanks so much for coming in.
Hey, thank you, Andy. And it's great being here.
Yeah, and you've got a lecture tonight at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center called A Trip North. So you were just briefly sort of telling me a little bit about it, but this sounds pretty wild. This sounds pretty cool. Extreme, weird, all of the above.
All of the above. Yeah, so what I did, you know, I grew up here in southeast Alaska, right in the town of Gustavus, just to the west of Juneau there, and I was down in California doing my graduate studies. I was doing my PhD in climate science down at Stanford University, and what I decided to do was go home the long way. So I walked and kayaked from Stanford campus all the way up to southeast Alaska, to the homeland.
So you were describing, you kind of basically walked from Stanford up across the Golden Gate Bridge, right?
And yeah.
On the way up and kept walking until you hit Port Angeles, and that's where your kayak was, and from there you kayaked.
That's right, yeah. So yeah. I literally walked off Stanford campus, the patio of the building where I had been doing most of my PhD work, and across the Golden Gate and up the coast from there. When I got to Port Angeles, Washington, that was about 1,000 miles walking. That took about 55 days. And then there I kind of took a little rest, got myself accoutered for my kayaking portion. Then I set off across the Strait of Juan de Fuca and up the Inside Passage. And that was about another 56, 57 days. So the whole thing was about 4 months solo and getting up home.
And as a little bit of background, you said you were doing this as part of an Indian Islands Institute program. Is that kind of, that institute was involved?
Exactly. Well, so I'm the founding director of Indian Islands Institute, and what that's all about. Some folks here in Juneau have heard about it. Some folks have worked with us, done courses with us. Some folks are supporters. So it's really great to have a chance to speak about that. Essentially, I grew up knowing this property out on the Indian Islands near Glacier Bay. The Indian Islands are a pretty magical place. They're probably about 70 miles west of Juneau, right in those rich ocean passes that connect the northernmost entrance to the Inside Passage that connects the inside waters to the Gulf of Alaska. And so
the Icy Strait?
Exactly. So you've got these islands in Icy Strait. You've got Pleasant Island, Lemassure Island as you go farther west, and the outer coast islands are the Indian Islands. And yeah, really a powerful place where all the mammals and seabirds are, and salmon, of course, are, they're all migrating right through those ocean passes. They're big, powerful tides. You can imagine the kind of place. And it's all protected land under the Forest Service, except there's this 1 5-acre homestead there. It's locally known as the Hobbit Hole. It's owned by a couple of brothers, Greg and Fred Howe. They've been living out there for like over 40 years as a, you know, small scale commercial fisherman, trolling for king and coho salmon mostly. And amazing guys, stories for days. And, you know, we would go out there. They've hosted weddings out there, memorials, all kinds of community celebrations. So it's way the heck out in the wilderness. And everybody who goes out there kind of falls in love with it. You know, it's just one of those powerful places. And so I grew up knowing that place as a boy. And there I was halfway through my PhD studies when that came up for sale. The Howe brothers had decided they were getting on in years. They were deciding to move on from this amazing isolated way of life. And I just thought, whoa, that is an amazing opportunity for education and research. You know, bring student groups out there, experiential education, getting them out of the classroom, learning from this this incredible living laboratory of Southeast Alaska. You know, we got the tallest coastal mountains in the world right there, big glaciers. We've got an incredibly rich, intact ecosystem that students can study. And what better way to get them fired up about science, about conservation, about environment, and get them passionate about the natural world? Have basic scientific laboratory facilities out there, and be able to maintain it as a public space for use for community events the way it has been.
Wow. So you used this trip that you took as a way to sort of draw attention to some of the work that was being done there, some of the potential that this place might have.
Exactly. It was kind of a symbolic homecoming. And so my symbolic starting and ending points were right from Stanford campus to the Indian Islands. I paddled into the Hobbit Hole on my 111th day on August 30 of 2014 after about 2,300 miles. And it was that was a pretty special moment.
Wow.
So,
well, I got to ask, what were some of the most harrowing? What was some of the wildest, you know, regale us with some of the things that maybe happened? I guess to start with, in the walk, what kind of challenges did you run across while walking?
You know, I actually I had a really inauspicious start to the walk. I'm setting off right from campus. First of all, it was raining. As you know, California has been, although it's slowing down now, it's been in a multi-year drought. It was the first day of rain they had had in months. So
of pack are you wearing?
I had an Osprey pack that was pretty small. I can't remember the liter size off the top of my head, but I really pared down.
Carrying 40 pounds, something like that?
Yeah, I was fully loaded with food and water, it was about 35 pounds. It was kind of funny because my brother came and visited me on the Oregon coast. He came and hiked with me for a couple days, and his pack for those couple days was about twice the weight and bulk as mine was for 55 days because, you know, when you have to pare things down, that's exactly what you do.
Yeah.
So I kept it as light as I could. And of course, that all changed when I got in the kayak. Then you're not nearly as concerned about the weight. You're not carrying it on your body.
So you're in the rain. First day.
Yeah, first day. So I'm walking up and just going through a concrete jungle, essentially. I had made my way out onto El Camino Real, which is sort of the most direct route. And this shows how little planning I had actually devoted to this thing. You know, I decided to do this maybe a month or two before I left. And in that month, I had to finish up my dissertation. I had to turn it in. I had to pack up my whole life in California. So basically planning for this thing took the back burner, and it showed on my first day because I'm walking up there and it shows how I'm a small town Alaska boy. It never went away.
Right.
I'm going up and I'm starting to get tired. I probably put on 20 miles and I'm looking around and I'm thinking, I don't know where I'm going to stay tonight. You know, in general, I would just find a spot, a quiet, isolated spot, and I would just throw down my bag, you know, and just camp out. And that worked every night except for this one because there is no green space on the way up. And so I just started going into a neighborhood. Turns out I was in a really wealthy town called Burlingame. And I tried this strategy that had worked for me when I was hitchhiking in Scotland, but I don't recommend it for the wealthy suburbs of San Francisco. I just knocked on a couple of doors and said, "Hey, you know, I'm this Stanford graduate. I'm trekking up the coast. This is my first day. I've just finished my PhD, and I'm on my way up to found this nonprofit field school. I was wondering if I could camp out in your yard." Right?
This is a story they hear all the time.
Oh yeah,
another Stanford grad's in the yard.
So a couple of people slam the door in my face, and I move on, and this cop car pulls up, right? Somebody had called the cops on me. And I honestly think the only thing that kept me out of jail for the night was that I still had my Stanford ID card with me. And because – so the guy, you know, this cop, he kind of sizes me up. He's like, "All right, I think you're telling the truth, but I don't want to see your face again." He's like, so just go down. El Camino Real is right there. You turn left. That's north. And just keep walking.
Yeah,
I don't want to see your
right.
face around here anymore. And so I did. So I went and got a hotel room, right, on my first night. And I was feeling really chagrined and embarrassed. But kept going, got across the Golden Gate. And from then on, it was high times. It was great.
So when you did the trip, that was your plan, I'm not going to ever stay in a hotel room. I'm going to only camp out. That was kind of part of the little internal rules you had about what you wanted to do?
Yeah, well, the rules include I didn't set that specifically as a rule. And I did end up getting sheltered spots a couple of times. I got a couple of hotel rooms, and I was able to stay with a couple of friends along the way, including the night when I was actually in San Francisco itself. But even though my lodging wasn't stipulated as a rule, I did for sure have a rule that I couldn't accept any rides. This whole thing from Stanford to from Stanford up to Indian Islands was going to be done under my own power.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people would pull up, and, you know, once I got out of the big city, a lot of people would pull up and be like, "Hey, man, you want a ride?" I'd say, "No, I'd explain the story. I got to walk the whole thing." And they'd say, "Well, that's kind of weird. Well, you want a beer?" I'd be like, "Oh, yeah.
Yes, fuel." Yeah, so, that is not against the rules.
once I did get out of the wealthy suburbs of San Francisco, I found a lot of hospitality. Those human moments were really what made the trip for me.
And then how about once you're in your kayak? Then it's more like wildlife and elements and things like that you're having to deal with. You have to, you know, safety becomes a real paramount concern once you're in a kayak.
Yeah, exactly. As soon as you get out on the water, the stakes are a lot higher. And so I did have numerous crossings, and God, I was jumping into the deep end because crossing the Strait of Juan de Fuca, my first day was actually the biggest crossing I had on the entire thing. It's somewhere, depending on exactly your route, somewhere between 11 and 15 miles to get across to Vancouver Island. It's a long crossing. You're out on the water for several hours, and, you know, things can change. Conditions can change during that time. And I had looked at it, and it looked like it was going to be a good day to go. I didn't know anything about the shipping traffic, which there's a ton of through there. And so I just figured if anything big was coming, I was going to see it and get the hell out of the way. But I did – that crossing went fine, and I made it across to Vancouver Island. But there were a number of crossings where I got out in open water that were – ill-advised, where I actually got into some really nasty chop situations where the wind and the tide were running counter to one another, and so it was stacking up these big waves and becoming kind of a maelstrom where I didn't know if I was going to keep upright. And I had drilled myself in the pool at Stanford with these little river boats. I had drilled myself on being able to do the Eskimo roll, you know, being able to right yourself if you go over. But boy, everything changes when you're actually out in cold water with a loaded boat and you're actually scared for your life. And so luckily I never did have to test that out. I never did capsize. But there were some times when I was really, really concerned.
Well, we're just scratching the surface here. And Zach, if you want to hear more from Zach and find out lots more about this trip north that Zach Brown took in conjunction with the Indian Islands Institute, you can go tonight to the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. You're doing two lectures, 6:30 and 8 o'clock. Is that right?
That's right. Yep.
Okay, so doors open typically at 6, and then there's the 6:30 lecture and then an 8 o'clock lecture. And Those lectures fill up, so get there early, folks, to talk to Zach and hear his presentation and see the presentation and all that. Zach, it's fascinating. We could talk on and on here. I wish we could go on and on. We've got more guests to come in, though, but I appreciate you dropping by and letting us know all about Trip North, and have a great lecture tonight.
Thank you.
All right, Andy. Thanks
Cheers.
So much. Back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today, and Laura Statz is joining me. Hey, Laura, how you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Thanks for coming in to talk about the Juno Community Health Fair that's coming up next weekend. Not this weekend, but next weekend.
Correct.
Saturday, March 18th. It goes from 8 a.m. to noon. It's at Thunder Mountain High School. So what are some of the cool things and important things people can get done there at the health fair next Saturday?
Okay, well...
So many.
There's so many things. So many things, yes, of course, Andy. Anyway, yeah, I've been organizing this for the past 3 years and have been having fun doing it. The first thing is it's a real opportunity for our Juno people to just go and think about their health, think about what they want to do, how they want to make changes to be a healthier person.
I think that's a really good point, that often these health fairs, you get the tests, and those are very important to get, and you get those things, but just being cognizant of your health as a thing to think about and go do and pay attention to is such a big step.
That is so right. Yeah, it's the difference between reacting to life and making conscious decisions. And so, yeah, just going to the health fair and immersing yourself in there's a ton of exhibits, and just giving yourself a chance to think, how do I want to make myself healthier? What goal do I want to make this year that I can attain? It's usually, actually what literature tells us is to make a small attainable goal. And those goals, those small attainable goals add up to big changes in your life.
Right.
So that's the first thing. The next thing is I have a vision about this health fair. I've been wanting to have just more than getting your blood drawn. I want it more than that. And so we've been, this is the third year we've been putting mini classes together. So I hope people check into those mini classes, because guess what? We have 63 volunteers to pull this little fair off.
Yeah, this little fair, I know I've been to these in the past, and they're massive undertakings.
Yeah, so there's 63 volunteers. So what I'm really hoping is that people are not going to have to stand in line. And so they'll be able to go to the mini classes that we've organize. So I can just talk a little bit about those.
Yeah.
9 o'clock, Dr. Cindy Cork, she's going to talk about health for your eyes. And 9:30, Cynthia Nickerson, our diabetes educator at Bartlett, is going to be talking about preventing diabetes and specifically about prediabetes. Emily Kane, she's going to be talking about understanding the lab work that you're going to be receiving. 10:30, Kristen Trombol. She is an interesting gal, and she's going to be talking about access consciousness and how you can dig deeper and learn to meditate and put some tools in your toolbox regarding that. And finally, at 11 o'clock, Dr. Berger Bostrop will talk about the importance of your posture. And you can, if you didn't catch that and you want to learn more, just go to the Bartlett website, www.bartletthospital.org, and just click on the health fair there on the homepage, and it'll take you, and it'll take you right to those classes.
And I understand
about.
Nolan the Colon.
Yes.
Is going to be making an appearance.
Nolan the Colon.
Always a highlight. A giant, life,
yes.
Larger than life.
Yes.
Sized colon.
Yeah.
Named Nolan.
Hey, and I've never seen Nolan the Colon. So
oh, boy.
This is really good. Of course, the digestive tract is extremely important to our health. So anyway, we'll have it there. Staff from Southeast Radiology will be there to talk about the importance of taking care of your colon.
Yeah. Now, I know that you were saying, like, you don't want it to just be the blood tests, and I think that's really great. But, of course, the blood tests are very important.
Absolutely.
And so what are some of the things that people typically, you know, what's being looked at in the blood test typically? Are there different stages, different sort of levels that you can get when you get your blood drawn, or how does that work?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, A, drink plenty of plain water. The lab tests are fasting, so fast for, they recommend 10 to 12 hours, but at least 8. But drink plenty of water. If you take medications, be sure to take your medications. So in general, these are quality, low-cost blood draws. The comprehensive blood draw is $45. I mean, a fraction of what all those blood tests would be. So that includes a complete blood count, a complete lipid profile, liver profile, kidney profile. I'm sure I'm forgetting a few, but it's comprehensive. Your electrolytes. Very comprehensive for just $45. Then you can also add thyroid stimulating hormone, check your thyroid out. A1C is another way to check to see if you have diabetes or prediabetes. Prostate, PSA, vitamin D level, of course, very good in these northern climates to know about that. They added a test for celiac disease, a digestive problem, vitamin B12, and also you can get your blood typing. Very inexpensive prices for all of those things.
And as you said, it's the Juno Community Health Fair, so much more than just the blood test. There's the mini classes that are running from 9 a.m. through to 11 a.m., and, of course, you can hang out with Nolan the Colon a little bit. That to me sounds great.
Okay.
Remember to fast if you are going to get the blood work done. So, again, it's in the morning, so that's not so hard, right?
No.
Just after 8 o'clock or so, don't have anything. And it's all happening.
8 p.m., don't have anything.
Yeah, right. And it's all happening to Saturday, next Saturday, March 18th, and it's at Thunder Mountain High School. Laura, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know about the health fair.
Thank you so much, Andy.
And that's it for Juno Afternoon today. Thanks to all my guests. Coming up next, All Things Considered.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Talks to President Pryor.